At this time, Mel and Dick begin the tech net. First time we've ever done this. Believe that, I'll tell you another. This is going to be TechNet number 1,157. Boy, these guys are dedicated. Started way back in, when, September of 1982. On another repeater. But that's another story. Main purpose of the TechNet, I'm repeating it for the 1,157th time, is that amateur radio operators suddenly realize that they've gotten involved into a pretty darn complicated hobby, and some of the questions need answering, like what rig should I buy, what antenna should I buy, what feed line should I be using, is my receiver working correctly, and there's 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio, so if you don't like the one you use, and try one of the other 25 that you haven't tried. It's a vast hobby. The main thing you can say about what is ham radio is, and what is the TechNet, is an attempt to ask questions about wireless technology combined with computers and video cassette recorders and DVDs and everything else, electronics in general. So the questions that are appropriate for the TechNet are those that a electronic enthusiast, namely a ham radio operator, would be interested in. So we go pretty far and wild sometimes, far and wide, far and wild, that's also true. On there. Occasionally we even get into the philosophy of ham radio and the philosophy of the people who are ham radio operators. So as long as we're not offending anybody, we allow some pretty far questions. So the way a person signs into the TechNet is to give Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So when we put your name down on the list, if you tell us yes, we know that we're going to come back to you for your chance to ask a question. Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
N2MB, and I got nothing to say, but I love listening. Good evening, Dick.
Boy, there's a guy with
WS2N, Paul, with a yes for a comment and a space report.
K2RXG.
K2AP, Joe, and no.
W2PNJ, Bob, yes.
K2LJH with a very good evening to you, Dick.
And good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
Okay, Mel, and that previous anonymous person was Sid. And before that, we had Bob with a yes, Joe, LXB, Barry, who claims he doesn't have a question, but you just wait and see. And Rich, we got more than enough to get going. Let me write down a couple of... I'm behind in my writing here. There we go. I got a letter from Rich, in which he showed me a picture of his rig as he's developing it. What a piece of hardware. Whoa. My goodness. You gotta send that picture to a few of your friends, Rich. What a piece of hardware. That's a stealthy looking transmitter. I think it's got hair on its chest. In fact, when you flip that switch, you better stand back a foot or two. Rich, go right ahead with your question. N2EO, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
And Dick, I had a comment also for an update. WS2N.
Yeah, I got you with a yes, Paul. And I think you're gonna be, let's see. I think you come right after Rich. And so we're not going to forget you. Good you brought to my attention. N2EO, you got it.
Okay, Dick. Really hard to talk. I'll make it brief. In the picture, that coil is wound in the quarter-inch copper tube. It's still getting a little bit warm. I'm wondering why would that coil still get back to that?
I'm doing a quick calculation here. That coil getting warm, I am guessing, is in the vicinity of 5 or 10 watts. So if I subtract 10 watts from what I believe is your power output, which I've just done, and if I then take the log of that, multiply it by 10,
you're losing the, there it is. Why in the world? Oh, I see what I did wrong. There it is. 0.03 dB. In other words, if 10 watts was being dissipated by that coil in that closed cabinet, that would represent 0.03 of a decibel of insertion loss because of that coil. Until that coil starts dissipating, let me pick a number, 50 watts, 100 watts, I wouldn't worry about it, Rich. That coil is made out of a pretty healthy piece of copper. It can take an awful lot of heat. I mean, a modern-day transistor can take junction temperatures of 200 degrees C. When I followed, trying to think of his call letters right now, Steve. When I followed Steve's advice, and Steve was recommending other transistors to me, KF2R, is it RE? You know the Steve I'm talking about. He checks in quite often. He told me about LD MOS transistors, and I looked up one of those transistors, and the data sheet tells us the junction of this transistor can take 200 degrees centigrade for brief periods of time during the operation. A human hand can just barely touch, I think it's 70 degrees C, very lightly, and you don't get a blister, but you just barely touch that. 70 degrees C, almost every self-respecting silicon transistor can take 150 C, and some of them can take 200 C. So the temperatures you're worried about there, Rich, are extremely mild compared to what that hardware can take. I see some nice wide straps going to that coil. The coil itself is nicely wound out of copper. When you're running the amount of power you're running, everything in the world is going to get warm. There's just no avoiding it. It turns out the circulating current in a pi tank circuit is a hell of a lot higher than what your milliammeter is reading on the plate tank circuit. If, for instance, your milliammeter is running one ampere of current on the 3,500-volt supply or whatever it is, if it was running 1 ampere, common sense would lead you to believe, well, there's probably an ampere flowing in the tank circuit. That RF current flowing in the tank circuit might be 35 amperes, and with skin effect, that 35 amperes is being spread over the thin layer of the copper on the top of that coil, 1/10,000th of an inch thick is a rough rule of thumb as to where the RF goes. In the case of my parallel kilowatt amplifier, for instance, 39 kilowatts was bouncing back and forth in that tank circuit, simply because when you get up to 432 with a pair of 4CX250Bs, and I think each one of them has, I'm trying to remember now, is it 5.5 picofarads, some number like that, the plate capacitance. Two of them in parallel, 11 picofarads, and 2,000 volt power supply. You go through the mathematics, and you realize that you can't make the plate tank circuit any lower in Q, because the minimum capacitance is already inside the tube, and you can't eliminate it. So you end up with a very high Q circuit, and the Q of the circuit really means how much voltage rise and how much current rise you get at resonance compared to what you're supplying, the circulating current. So you've got a significant amount of circulating current. The fact that your circulating current is high tells me the Q of your tank circuit is high. In general, that's good, as long as you're not dissipating a whole lot of power in the tank circuit. I think you're not. You would be making the copper, you'd be melting solder joints. And I think before you increase the diameter of that coil, I believe you were developing some softening of the solder. I think it's relatively normal, and I think you'll soon discover not to worry about that. I believe you've already added that transformer to take your 209 volts up to 240 to keep the transformer happy, and so I'll bet you that that rig is flying pretty nicely. With that higher Q of the plate tank circuit that maybe is being shown by the heating, particularly at the 10 and 15 meters, I'm guessing that's where you're getting the greatest heating. That higher Q really means you're getting greater rejection of the higher harmonics, and therefore less TVI. You may still get some TVI from simple front-end overload. In other words, you could build nowadays a state-of-the-art rig where all undesired frequencies coming out of the amplifier are 100 dB suppressed. That's a state-of-the-art rig. even with that, you might very well get TDI from the next two or three neighbors on each side, depending on the quality of the set they're using and how good the front-end filter is on that, simply because you're radiating a hell of a lot of steam very close by. A good television set can receive a signal of probably 20 microvolts and be very happy, and you're giving it volts. And that's a lot of overload of the front end because you're so nearby. Inverse square law means that every time you halve the distance between your antenna and that television set, it gets four times as much power, twice as much voltage every time you halve the distance. So because you're next door a block away, or let's say a next door, 150 feet away, compared to the television station, which is 10 miles away, that's a huge ratio, and therefore front-end overload is very easy to happen. One of the things that amazes people, and I'm going a little bit off to a tangent here, I'm giving instruction to some new people that have joined the salt mine I work at, and these people have come out of a good school with a good electrical engineering degree. And when you first tell them what is the power spread between a transmitter and a receiver, I'll explain that, it just blows their mind. In other words, a simple transmitter running, let's say, 1 watt of power plus 30 dBm. That's what 1 milliwatt is. 1,000 times more than 1 milliwatt is 1 watt. That's why it's plus 30 dBm. And most engineers nowadays live in the dBm world when it comes to calculating a signal strength. And a good receiver, like the one you're listening to me on right now, if it's working well, can tolerate a quarter of a microwatt, a quarter of a microvolt, and sometimes less. And that's numbers like minus 120 dBm is what the signal generator would be set at when you measure the threshold of that receiver. So 120 dBm negative is the receiver sensitivity. 30 dBm positive is the power output of a transmitter. The ratio between those two is 150 decibels. The number rolls off the tongue very easily. You soon realize that that is 1 with 15 zeros after it is the ratio of power coming out of your simple 1-watt QRP transmitter versus the sensitivity of your receiver. You suddenly realize that if there isn't a tremendous amount of shielding, isolation, distance, and whatever between that transmitter and that receiver, that transmitter can easily overload that receiver. The requirement for your duplexing filter in the case of a repeater setup, the requirement for the transmit-receive relay that flips your antenna back and forth between the receiver and the transmitter, how many dB of isolation does it have? You'd be amazed what ratios we're looking for here. And until you go through the numbers, it's not obvious. A person fresh out of school that hasn't really had a whole lot of wireless experience is sometimes amazed that they lay out a printed circuit board. The transmitter is on one side of the printed circuit board, the receiver is on the other side, and if you're not careful, the guys who do the layout of the board for you, the mechanical engineering, or what's it called now, I'm going to call it the mechanical engineering department that does the layout of the board for you, might run the cable for the transmitter near some of the receiver circuitry just because it's convenient to do that layout, and they wonder why they get desensitization on their own printed circuit board, even though everything's perfectly shielded. And the word shielded is a very relative word. So you gotta really treat a receiver front end with a lot of respect if you want it not to be overloaded. I know I'm very far off of your subject, but I'm pretty sure, Rich, you've done what you've been done. I see that you've got wide strapping everywhere, copper tubing everywhere, good solder joint, screws holding it all together. Even if the solder joint melted, the screws are going to hold it together. I don't think there's much more you can do to keep that cooler other than running water through that coil. And by the way, I think I recognize the way your circuit is set up is very unique in that the output of the tubes go through a coupling capacitor before it goes into the tank resonator circuit. Therefore, I think your tank resonator circuit, your plate tank circuit, is running at DC ground potential. There isn't even the 3,000 volts is not on the actual coil itself, if I understand your circuitry correctly when I look at that picture. Back to you, Rich, for some further words. N2EO. the guy with a really stealthy transmitter, K2RIW in the tech net.
Comment at K2KEY.
Yeah, stand by a minute, Rich. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. I don't know if I have used myself or convinced myself, which is very easy. I can do many times. But what I did, I took the components from when I built the homebrew amp, big amp, and I set off the coils kind of hot. You know, I think that should be cooler. I took them out and I did a homebrew silver plating job of all the straps and coils and the whole business. You know, one of these homebrew silver plating jobs, so not the classic cleanest, you know, silver plating job you could get, because, you know, you got to really be experienced at it. But it did silver plate. They used, you know, my father worked one time in the photographic business, so he saved me the silver nitrate fluid, you know, that they used after developing. So I used that stuff and, you know, made up a tank, the whole business. Silver plated the whole works, and I think maybe I convinced myself that things are running a little cooler, or am I just imagining it, Dick? Over.
I got a comment on that one, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Barry right after I give a couple of words on this one. Yeah, Cool Amp is the name of, is the brand name of a company that does immersion silver plating, I call it. It's not real electroplating. You get the one or two molecules thick of silver. And one or two molecules thick of silver is nowhere near the thickness you want. You really want 150 micro-inches of silver to do a really good job. And there's another catch. You just don't go to a company that does silver plating of silverware, you know, the things you, your knives and forks and spoons. That kind of silver plating, you put it on top of copper, and the resistivity of the surface will probably be worse than it was with copper. I ran into this problem with a consulting job I did in Salt Lake City, oh, 5 or 6 years ago. Got sent out there because they wanted to increase the Q of a cavity filter they were using. This would happen to be at 9 gigahertz, but the phenomena was the same. They had this beautiful copper cavity that was resonating at 9 gigahertz. They wanted the Q to be higher, so the insertion loss of that filter was lower to do the testing of the ferrite devices, the spheres they were testing. And they had gone out to a company that does silver plating. They added the silver plating, and the Q of the cavity went down. It got worse. You check with the people who used to do silver plating for microwave work, and it is an art form. To do that kind of silver plating requires fancy chemicals, fancy procedures of plating the current, of plating the silver on, deplating a little bit of it, buffing in between and whatever, to try to get the right grain size and conductivity between the individual grains of the silver plating that's going on to get good high conductivity. Very difficult. A solid bar of silver that comes out of the foundry has a certain amount of resistivity. When you electroplate that silver onto your particular object, you're not getting the same grain size. You're getting a whole lot of boundaries and whatever at the microscopic level. So simply silver plating. The chances of it doing a good job, if you haven't gone to a place that knows how to do it for radio purposes, the chances of you getting silver plating you'll be happy with are pretty slim, very, very low, in fact. On top of that, as I said, to really do the job correctly, you want approximately 150 micro-inches of silver. And as such, you're not going to get that with this simple immersion process. We're only getting a couple of molecules. If I was really smart, I could calculate how many micro-inches is a molecule, but it's very small. And so you're not getting enough skin depth. And so should you silver plate? Well, for reasons of beauty, maybe. But for us to do it on our particular circuit, I think the answer is almost no. If you take, for instance, my so-called parallel kilowatt amplifier, where the strip line there on the plate circuit is 8 inches wide. The current density on that is so low that if you made it out of carbon granules, you'd get almost the same performance. And silver plating may make you feel happy. The chances of it really being an improvement are very, very slim. So be careful with your judgments of silver plating. You may have thought you saw some improvement, Mel. I think the chances are slim. There's a slim chance if you did a very careful laboratory measurement with some good instrumentation, you may have found out that after you did the silver plating, by the process that you used, there's a chance that it did nothing because it's so thin that the RF is really going down to the copper that was there in the first place and ignoring your one or two molecules of silver on the surface. But the chances are nothing at all happened, and if anything did happen, it may have been a detriment. So you can easily get sucked into the silver plating theory, and it's not all that it's cracked up to be if you didn't do it very carefully. I wonder if you've ever done some silver plating of either of your antennas or plate tank circuits, particularly when you first operated on 1296, Barry. M2 Moonbound, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, yes I did, and it was a waste of time. Exactly. I think dipping it in molten silver might have worked, but wasn't able to afford that. I just wanted to make one comment. Mel said that he thought that the tank circuit ran cooler. Dick, I want your opinion on this. Could it have run cooler simply because silver plating, it helped conduct the heat away from it? In other words, it wasn't running any more efficiently, but it was able to conduct its heat away a little bit better.
Good theory. I'm very doubtful of that, Barry. If I asked a whole lot of questions to Mel, I think I'm going to find out that he had a certain number of ounces of copper in his original circuit. Then when he did the silver plating, he added a couple of micro ounces of copper, of silver on top of that. The conductivity of silver versus copper electrically is like 3 or 4% improvement. Thermally, silver conducts heat a little bit better than copper, I think, but I'm not positive of that. But again, it's only going to be a few percent. So the difference in thermal conductivity, the difference in electrical conductivity are only a few percent, but he had micro ounces of silver on top of ounces of copper. I think you see where I'm going here. You could spit in the ocean out there in front of Far Rockaway and try to measure the increase in the tide because you did that. And I think you see where I'm going. But back to you, Barry, for a comment on that. N2MB, KQRIW.
Okay, yeah, that was my only feelings on the matter, that he might have possibly improved its ability to conduct heat away from the coil, but you don't think even that. Silver is a great conductor of heat. I don't know if you've ever done this, but if you take a dime and just run it over your pants, you can actually feel the heat in the dime very quickly. Can't do that with a penny, but I think the density of a dime, the silver in it, is a hell of a lot better than in a penny, though. You know, in other words, it's not like it was coated with silver. It's pretty thick. The old dimes, anyway.
But even the old dimes were a silver alloy. And they were always worried at each instant of time whether or not the metal content of the coin was worth more than the coin, and therefore people would start melting them down. So you're getting a significant alloy of silver even in that old-fashioned dime. And when you rub the copper penny versus the dime, you get two different thicknesses of metal, two different masses of metal. The way the copper rubs against your clothing versus the way the silver rubs against the clothing, there could be a very difference in heat going on there. There's also something called the triboelectric effect. It usually affects insulating materials. In other words, if I take a rubber balloon and rub it against my hair, it turns out that animal fur and the kind of rubber that's in a balloon are on the opposite ends of the scale of something that's called the triboelectric series. Just like you've got the electromotive series, which tells you never bring copper and aluminum in contact with each other, because you're getting a battery when you do that, and one will erode the other. By the same token, there are certain insulating materials, and fur and rubber happen to be very far apart, which means when you rub that rubber balloon against your hair, you develop a huge charge on the rubber balloon, and obviously that charge will electrostatically make it stick to the wall for quite a period of time. I now own some instrumentation where I can measure that voltage, and rubbing that balloon against your hair is developing a static electric charge on the balloon that probably is numbered like 20,000 volts. Very, very little current, but quite a lot of voltage, maybe even as high as 50,000 volts. And so if you If you go and Google the word high voltage experiments, you'll come up with a whole bunch of websites that show you all kinds of fancy ways of making sparks that go over long distances, how to build a Van de Graaff generator, how to build a Tesla coil, how to build a Windhurst machine, and so on, and what kind of fun experiments you can do with them. So what I'm getting at is the molecular surface of the copper penny versus the dime, and the way it rubs on your clothing, how much charge you build up, how much friction you make, how much heat you make, a lot of variables involved there. A simple seeming experiment will teach you once again. If you think the experiment is simple, you probably don't understand the experiment. Back to you, Barry.
Okay. I'll let you pick it up. But what I think you basically said tonight was, if Mel had taken and dipped the coil in molten silver, the copper coil, pulled it out real quick, in other words, coated the thing with a lot of silver, that would have worked great.
I agree with you. That would be the best way to do it. Very few of us can afford to do that. I don't think a silverware, silver plating company does it that way. I think they do it by electroplating. You'd be putting on two thick a layer of silver. You then have to do all kinds of things to make it look good afterwards, to get rid of the drips and whatever, and the variations of thicknesses. I think to redesign the circuit so that it has high surface area where the RF current is flowing is going to give you a hell of a lot more bang for the dollar as opposed to silver plating some particular circuit. There's an awful lot of filters and things like that that I've been taking apart recently to see what's inside, to see how they work and how to make them work better and why do they work so well. There was a 10-pole filter that came into my hands a couple of months ago. I put it in front of a network analyzer and tuned it up to my favorite frequency that I was working on, 900 megacycles at the time. And the filter with 10 poles of filtering had something like 7/10 of a dB of insertion loss. That amazed the hell out of me across a 10 megacycle bandwidth. And when I went and measured today, believe it or not, I put it on a swept signal generator. It was a spectrum analyzer with tracking signal generator. And I found out that the skirt selectivity, in other words, the reject regions of this filter, 10 megacycles away, is 120 decibels of rejection. I was amazed by that. And so you look inside that filter and say, boy, that must be silver plated to do all that. Yes, it is, but it's pretty yucky looking silver plating because it was done a whole lot of years ago and it's heavily tarnished. The good news is that silver sulfate, that tarnished look you get to silver, is also a pretty good conductor. But is all that performance coming from the silver plating, or is it coming from the design of the filter? I say it's coming from the design of the filter. The guy who built this filter really understood RF. It was a DB company, and boy, that company knows how to build filters and hybrids and whatever. They made it just thick enough in the right spot, and good variable capacitors in just the right spot. Darn good design. So good design goes a hell of a lot further than silver plating, 98% of the time, in my opinion. Back to you, Rich. Interesting set of questions. N2EO, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, one more comment that they can see why.
Hey, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, sorry. No, I was just going to say that most of the amplifiers that you see, the high-end amplifiers that they're selling, these companies that are making these high-end amplifiers, one of the things that they specify, silver-plated tank circuits. So you're going to say to me that with all hype, in fact, a lot of the old surplus equipment that used tear apart had silver-plated wire in it. So you feel that with all hype, that it actually meant very little of that silver plating that they did on the equipment of World War II or the now amplifiers? Do you feel that then that there's really no advantage to it? Over.
You're going to get a complicated answer on this one. The word hype suggests that somebody was doing something for a facade, doing something to be deceptive in order to increase sales, in order to sell more equipment, and that's one of the definitions of hype in some people's mind. It connotes that kind of a philosophy. And I think there wasn't that kind of hype. What I'm getting at is, up until, I'm going to pick a number, 20 years ago, the world believed silver plating was the right thing to do. Just like up until 50 years ago, people believed that showing discrimination against certain races and certain religions was perfectly all right. People used to believe that, and now we're a lot smarter. We realize that with good education, almost all prejudice is foolish and dumb. It's the wrong thing to do for a whole lot of reasons. Well, people used to believe silver plating was great. So I don't think the, in many cases, the manufacturer was paying extra money for that silver plating. So he believed he was really developing something of quality and delivering a good product, and therefore he advertised it. But in the bottom line, I believe that a high percentage of the times that silver plating was used, it didn't make a significant improvement, and in many cases it made a detriment. You could have beautiful looking shiny silver plating on top of a copper resonator circuit, and to the eye it says, boy, that looks like quality. But you get down to the microscopic level, if they didn't do it with just the right process, that silver plating surface could have higher resistivity than the ugly-looking tarnished copper that could have been there. The tarnish you get on top of copper is only a couple of molecules thick. The RF energy just goes through that until it gets down to the real solid copper, because it's going down 0.001 of an inch at most of our VHF frequencies, and that's where it really does the work. It's very similar to the guy who asked the question, gee, I'm building my 80-meter dipole out of 14-gauge household wire. Will the dipole work with less quality if I leave the rubber insulation on the wire? Well, you leave the rubber insulation on the wire has a slightly larger outside diameter, has a little bit more wind resistance, and maybe the ice in the wintertime will stick to it, and that's a disadvantage. But RF-wise, the rubber insulation is not there. The signal that you're transmitting or the signal you're receiving on 80 meters goes through that outer rubber layer until it gets down to the copper, and there it does what it's supposed to do. And by the same token, when you've got copper oxide on top of your wire, it is so thin, it's an insulator, and it has essentially very little effect. So, did it help? I think it almost never does in those case spaces you're talking about. But did the manufacturer do it for hype reasons? No. He really believed it. That was the belief in those days. And if I surveyed the engineering department of a good number of radio producing vendors these days, a significant percentage of them still believe that silver plating is fantastic, regardless of how you did the silver plating. Very few of them have the ability to get to a company that knows how to do radio quality silver plating. Those are my words. I'm not quite sure what the words are. The houses that had that skill, because it was so poorly recognized, because they had so little business, almost all of them are out of business. If you had to find a radio-savvy silver plating house today, there used to be a number of them in Brooklyn. I'm not convinced that one of them exists today. And so, could you find one? Is it in Silicon Valley in California? Is it run by a company that also runs a foundry and knows how to build a micro-miniature circuit? Maybe. So be a little slow on adding the silver plating. Do it for beauty if you like, but if you're thinking of making a radio improvement, I'm becoming skeptical, as you can tell. And the differences we're talking about, it would take extremely highly calibrated laboratory equipment in most of these circumstances to see the 0.01 and 0.03 dB of difference we're talking about. So I think you've done it right, Rich. I don't think there's much more you can do to keep that coil cool other than wind it out a wider copper strap in which it won't fit in there anymore. And the amount of heat that you feel, if it doesn't burn your hand, it's minor compared to the watts you're running. When you calculate decibels, it's darn small. And I, once again there, Rich, I'm guessing that your coil is running at grounding potential, because of the way that coupling capacitor with the RF choke is on the actual plate of your tube. Very nice circuit. N2EO, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Okay, K2RIW. That's it, then why not? And so you know. Yeah, the coupling caps come right off the plate. So there is no DC voltage on that coil. No, I wasn't concerned about what was. I was concerned about maybe, you know, doing some long-term damage, unsoldering the connections. I keep that thing down on and off for 5 minutes and opened it up. I'm able to touch the coil, and I can hold my hand on it for a few seconds. But any more than 4 or 5 seconds, it gets somewhat uncomfortably warm where it would put me. Can I take it?
But somewhat uncomfortably warm is 70 degrees centigrade. Your solder is not going to melt until you're 2 or 3 times higher in temperature. Yes, you did have melting solder before. I think you're not going to run into it now, and you've also got those straps screwed down as well as soldered, and the chances of that giving you any grief. I think you're worrying unnecessarily, Rich. I presume the heat is maximum at either 10 or 15 meters, your highest frequency. And while you're worrying about the heat of the coil, what about the range switch that's selecting that particular tap? The actual contact of that range switch. Oh, I wonder what kind of temperature they're running at. Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, okay, Dick. Well, maybe I'll just leave it alone. I had bought a silver plating kit, which came Friday. It's an electroplating kit. It uses a battery and a conductive brush. One side of the battery goes to the brush, one side to the work, and you push the gel on and an electroplate. But from what you're saying, it might actually be a detriment.
Yeah, the actual kit that you bought, was it being sold for making improvement in radio circuits, or was it being sold for making improvement in the beauty of things that you want to do electroplating? Back to you on that one, Rich.
I bought it from a company called Antique Electronic Supply in Tempe, Arizona. I used it when I did some antique work for replating switches, more for beauty. So maybe I'll just forget it.
Okay. You could do an experiment of doing it on the coil and see if you see an improvement. And I'd be reluctant to do that, though, unless you had a way that you could remove the silver plating. And maybe you don't have that, because there's a medium-high chance that when you do that method of silver plating, which is very simplistic compared to the houses that were doing it for radio purposes, the chances of you getting improvement are very, very slim. I think it's a high chance you're going to get a detriment for doing it. But then again, could you measure 0.03 dB of insertion loss of a tank circuit in a direct measurement? No way. I mean, the National Bureau of Standards, with their instrumentation, to accurately measure 0.03 dB of change is a little bit difficult for them. For you and me in our basement, it's out of the question. But you can do the indirect measurement. In other words, by adjusting the tank circuit for resonance and a certain amount of power output, measure how much the coil rises in temperature with a thermistor. There's ways you can, or with a thermal imaging camera. And even there, you got to be careful. The thermal imaging camera, you think it's going to show you the temperature of things. I'm now using a thermal imaging camera, a fun toy. My goodness. I wish it wasn't so darn expensive. I think they're $25,000, $30,000 a copy. But you look at things thermally, and boy, you get a different picture. You look at a human being wearing a set of glasses with a thermal imaging camera, and the glasses are these great big black objects in front of the guy's face. His nose is glowing like anything, because it's a warm object, if you know what I mean. He takes off his glasses, and he looks considerably more strange than Spock ever looked in any of the science fiction movies you've ever seen. So you look at a person with a thermal imaging camera, it's really strange. However, what you're seeing is not temperature. You're seeing the product of temperature and emissivity. You could have a shiny piece of copper in front of a thermal imaging camera, and the piece of copper could be hot or cold, and to the thermal imaging camera, it'll look the same. You wave your hand in front of that piece of copper, and you'll see the thermal imaging camera jump up and down in response from the copper. Well, I said shiny piece of copper, a dull piece of copper to an infrared imaging camera looks shiny. And therefore the image of your hand in the copper acting like a mirror is what the camera is seeing, and therefore it's seeing the heat of your hand reflecting in the copper. So you've got to be very careful how you mount the things you're looking at. Well, that's called the problem of emissivity. A black body is something that emits all the thermal energy it can, and you could say a shiny piece of aluminum is a white body. In other words, it doesn't emit very well. Therefore, the thermal imaging camera doesn't give you the response you think you're going to get. So even to do that experiment, when you look at a silver-plated coil versus a copper-plated coil, and they have different amount of thermal reflectivity acting like a mirror, it's going to give you a different response. It's hard to judge. So not easy to judge this. Probably the best judgment in the world is either a thermistor or your fingers touching the coil after it's been running for a certain length of time. If I was in your shoes, I don't think I would do it unless I was really, happy with everything else of the amplifier and just want to find out what's going to happen and if I had a way of removing it. Okay, the next person who was on our TechNet list, I think it is Paul, WS2N. And Paul, go right ahead with your question, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Paul, it's really a comment or an update from 2 weeks ago. We talked about tracing the wires for your house, the Romex wires in my case, using an AM radio. And what I used was always around 40 meters in that area, and it worked out good. You could detect the noise by taking a compact fluorescent light and screwing it in one circuit, the end of the circuit, and you could trace those wires back. Well, the week went by, and I finally decided, well, I wanted to cut into this one Romex. I wanted to put a junction box in to run another light for the house. But it was good doing that, because when I'm in this crawl space in the attic, in my attic, and there's all these Romex wires, you get that feeling, you want to, now it's time to cut one of these. Now, at the same time, because I only got the one circuit shut off, I know of another circuit that's live. I'm able to run an extension cord up with the drop light, and I have two flashlights for backup, because when you cut this wire, now you've got to, you've got to rejoin these two, plus you've got to run, I had to run two wires out from it, so there's four Romex wires going in into this one box. You've got to strip the wires and put the wire nuts on, and everything all has to be done in place. You have to have everything with you, proper tools, proper utility knife and wire strippers and all. So, it's nice to be able to do that, because you don't have to shut the whole house down and just work with flashlights. I had the drop light up there, and was able to shut it down maybe a half hour later, have everything back on. But it did work out okay. I think I just wanted to give you an update on that, and we'll give you a space report later on. Back to that WS2N.
Yeah, I think it was Bob, but I'm not sure, PNJ. I'm so darn forgetful. Somebody mailed me an email last week showing me the number of websites that sell a beautiful device being used by people in the electrical wiring business, electrical contractors. They sell these devices as cheap as, I think, $9, and as expensive as $45 or $60, which inject a signal into the wiring. You plug one thing into the particular socket you care about, and you go back with this probe to the fuse box, and you touch individual wires with the probe, or bring the probe near the wires, and by way of both audio and metering, it lets you know which wire you're identifying. So there are identifying circuits you can buy, and all of a sudden I can't find that particular email this man mailed me, and I think it was Bob, they sell it very nice.
Yeah, I use that every day, Dick.
Okay, tell us, Barry, what is it called, how many dollars, and where did you buy it?
Okay, real good. Well, first off, one of the easiest places to buy it these days is an alarm supply house. Those guys, I use it for alarm purposes. It actually started its life with the telephone company. They're the first ones to have used it. And it's basically, as you say, it's a little induction device. You stick it on the wire, and then you have this thing they call a toner. There's a lot of companies making it. I run out to my car right now if you want, and I'll get the brand name that I chose. There's many of them, and most of them work about the same. There's no big difference between them. You put your toner, your receiving device, which is like an induction receiver, you put it near the wire, and you're going to hear this do-do-do-do tone, which is being produced by the little transmitter device. Not RF stuff. And the device, both pieces, will probably run you about $60 to $90, halfway decent. You don't have to worry about if the wire was live. It could take up to 200-300 volts if you put it right across the AC power line. Not going to hurt it. And if you want, I'll run in the other room right now. You can go to any alarm supply house. There's a company called Jenny Electronics. I can give you their phone number if you want, that sells it. And I say it runs about $90 for both pieces. And I'll come back in a minute and give you the brand name of it.
Okay. Yeah, they come in various dollar values, various brand names, and various little doodads with them. It turns out that Paul WS2N found a very inexpensive way. He just took a modern-day fluorescent replacement light bulb, plugged it into a lamp, plugged the lamp into the socket that he cared about, and then went back with his radio at the fuse box and identified the wires. And so... that's a very crafty approach for the transistorized radio. So you could say he did it for $5. I'm guessing that's the price of one of these modern-day fluorescent light bulbs. And it's not quite as sophisticated as the professional piece of equipment you're talking about, Barry, but good job for him. It's a nice thing to know about, and it's something that I need. I'm probably going to use the fluorescent light bulb circuit technique, because I don't need that thing often enough to go out and spend the money to get the professional grade. You're in the business, Barry, of installing alarms and whatever, and doing correcting people's household wiring. So to you, it's a very valuable tool. I bet you've had it for quite a few years. Possibly Barry's already back from his car. I wonder if he carried a handy talkie with him so he can hear me talking while he's doing this. And 2MB, if you're there, K2RIW.
Okay, give me 60 more seconds. I'll be right back, N2MB.
Look, we're going to go to somebody else, and we're going to come back to you, Barry, so don't worry. Okay, fun thing. Let's see now. Bob, was it you that mailed me that beautiful email that I all of a sudden can't find, where you gave me the number of brand names of these tracing devices? W2PNJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Negative on that, Dick. That was not me. I do have a question. I have a pesky... combination smoke detector and carbon monoxide detector that has been going off with when I use my amplifier. Not right away, it's like a saturation, and all of a sudden after a few minutes. So I went up in the attic, I put a large ferrite right across the room that feeds that one inch round metal box. I use it's only one lead going in, 1/14-2 Romex with ground going in. And I put the ferrite on that. I had to climb in the attic to do it. It wasn't easy. And lo and behold, it went off again today. So this time I opened up, I dropped the smoke detector down. And it's, you know, it's connected with the black and white 14-gauge wires. And I put a ferrite on each of the conductors, one on the white and one on the black. It's small ferrite, you know, I believe it's got a quarter-inch diameter inside hole. So I haven't turned on the rig yet, but I'm going to try that. You think that would help it? K2RIW, W2PNJ.
I'm back.
Okay, Barry's back, but I'm going to go with Bob first here. I think the chances of the two individual ferrites on the two individual wires versus one ferrite over both wires, the chances of the individual ferrites being significantly better is a little bit low, Bob. Those two wires really constitute twin leads. In other words, your household wiring really is a kind of twin lead as far as the 120 volts are concerned. One is the hot and the other one's the return. And so you're using those wires in a differential manner when you're hooked up to a ConEd or LiPa or whatever. And RF-wise, those two wires are one solid copper conductor. And the RF energy from your antenna gets both of those wires equally. So therefore, a ferrite around both of them is going to get as much as you're going to get out of ferrite. Depending on how big the ferrite is another big factor. You need a bigger and bigger piece of ferrite to get enough shielding when you go to lower and lower frequencies. If, for instance, you were a guy who likes running a kilowatt on 80 meters, and if your dipole was built into the attic or not very far away from the house, the amount of RF energy that can be coupled into your household wiring can be huge. A buddy of mine named George, W2KRM, used to have the condition where he went on the air at 80 meters. The fluorescent light in his kitchen would light even though the switch was off. His household wiring was picking up enough RF energy to light the fluorescent light in the ceiling of the kitchen of his house. And so it would take a pretty good chunk of ferrite to shield that. In the case of your smoke detector, CO2 detector, obviously it's a very sensitive circuit, and it's got a simple RF overload is what I'm detecting here. My best guess is that when you go to Radio Shack and you buy one of these great big chunks of ferrite, they sell larger ones. They sell the kind where you can put a couple of them on the same piece of wire. And when I say wire, I mean the pair, the black and the white. I think you should put it around both. Go ahead and do the experiment with the individuals. I think there's a high probability that it's not going to do enough for you. Anything you can do to change the dressing of the wiring relationship-wise, by that I mean moving the antenna, of course that's not easy. Could you redress the wiring in your house? Of course that's not easy. If there was a specific resonance, you probably could kill the resonance with a stump. In other words, put in a breakout box and put another parallel piece of wire going to a socket that goes nowhere. If it was tuned correctly, that could stop it. But I think ferrite is the right way to do it. You need more ferrite, a bigger chunk. After that, and if that doesn't do it, you may be down to building in some kind of a real filter on the 110-volt connection to that CO2 smoke detector. You've got the kind that's powered by the 110-volt line, and it probably has a backup battery also. One of mine runs on a battery only, and it never had any RF sensitivity. The ones that run on the 110-volt line, of course, the 120-volt line, are a lot more sensitive because they've got a very large antenna connected to them. To climb in there and start putting in, bypass capacitors, this ceramic bypass capacitors, 001, I'd be reluctant to do that because you're essentially changing the design of the thing. Let's hope the ferrite's going to do it. Bob, do come back and tell us what you did see with the two individuals when you do the experiment. And also, do you have enough room, I'm pretty sure you do, to add a larger one? And you could also cascade them. If you really took apart one of these bounding devices that's made for a dipole, like Unidella and W2DU and others, you'll find out it's got a number of ferrite toroids wrapped around the coax cable. The ones that are inexpensively made have smaller toroids and a lesser number of them. To get down to 160 meters or 80 meters to get really good isolation in one of those bounding devices, I'll bet you that whole white tube is filled up with ferrite toroids, quite a number of them. As you cascade more and more of them, you get more and more benefit. And I know that doesn't sound sensible to some people, but believe me on that one. W2PNJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Thank you. I will definitely do that. I have the room in the attic to add more, but I'll see how they work inside the 4-inch round box. Thanks again. I'll be on the side listening.
JJ, with a comment.
Yeah, go ahead. We had about a triple there. We're going to pick up each one of you, so don't worry. Doug first, go ahead.
Yeah, very good evening, Dick. I'm wondering if he would get more attenuation. I think he should simply clamp on type ferrite. If he were to use a round ferrite like a donut and actually wrap several turns of the wire around that, I think he would get some more attenuation if he has the room.
You're absolutely right. if he buys a big enough toroid, and even though he's separating the individual black and white wires, I would keep them twisted and wrap them through multiple turns of the toroid, would give him more benefit, without a doubt. And therefore, you don't need as much ferrite if you can make multiple turns of it. If you study how a ferrite bead does its job, I'm going to try to give you an explanation on that. Make your hand into a fist, but have your thumb sticking out to the right. This is the right hand, of course. And make believe that your fingers are wrapped around a piece of wire. Make believe the current is flowing on that piece of wire in the direction of your thumb. Your fingers now curled around the wire are showing exactly what the magnetic field around that wire is trying to do. And that magnetic field is going in air. When you put a ferrite bead over your piece of wire, that magnetic field that represents the curving of your fingers is now going through the ferrite, and the ferrite conducts magnetic field 10, 50, 30, times better than air. Therefore, the magnetic field is more easily developed, and that's a fancy way of saying your wire now has more inductance per length. It develops a stronger magnetic field for the same amount of current. That's the definition of an inductor. It develops a strong magnetic field for a small amount of current because of the multiple turns. That's one way that a coil of a transformer primary does it. But the core of the transformer, the iron, is conducting the magnetic field, and that's what really makes it work. So the ferrite beads provide a much better path for the magnetic field, and that gives you isolation. It makes the wire act like an RF choke. Putting more and more ferrite beads on in cascade gives you more and more choking action. Or if the wire itself has multiple turns around or through the ferrite, again, the magnetic field can be developed more easily, and you're getting more inductance per length. So now there's another problem you've got here. You've got to make sure that the ferrite you're using has good response at the frequency of interest. Well, when it comes down to frequencies like 80 and 40 and 20 meters, it's hard to get ferrite that's not going to work well there. If you were up at 902 megacycles, the number of pieces of ferrite that you can get that work well at 902 megs is quite small. You've got to be a little bit careful on that one. And what we're talking about here is the grain size of the powder, of the powdered iron or the ferrite. Very similar to what happens when you build a transformer for 60 cycles, you can make the EI laminations a certain thickness. If you go to 400 cycles or 10 kilohertz, you need much thinner lamination to stop the eddy current. So size of the particles of the iron or ferrite or powdered iron or thickness of the laminations of the transformer are part of the variables that affect what frequency you can go to. I think we also had Rich and 2EO, and I bet you we had Mel also on this one. Rich, you wanted to add a comment, and 2EO?
Yeah, Dick. I was going to suggest that he put a 0.001 right across the line at the
chances of that doing it are not great, because what I think is happening is that the wiring of his house is acting a little bit like a dipole. You and I know that the tips of the dipole have got very high voltage. His wire where he's plugging in the CO2 smoke detector is at the end of that particular run, which is like being at the tip of the dipole. Therefore, the voltage out there is very high, and we're not talking about differential voltage, we're talking about common mode voltage. In other words, both his black and his white wire are both flying up and down with RF voltage, and that's the tip of the dipole where the voltage is maximum, and his CO2 detector is an ionizing device. When you have a ionization source near the tip of a dipole, it literally creates a ball of ionized material in air around that wire. It's creating a conductor into free space, so to speak. And so the RF current flowing through that ionized path is what I think is giving him a false alarm. And so if he could put his ceramic capacitors from each wire to a good RF ground, it would help. But across the wires themselves might not do it. I think it's likely not to do it. And a good RF ground out there where the smoke detector exists doesn't exist. Could he put a shield around it? No, I wouldn't want to do that. He may not have free flow of the air, and therefore it would affect the amount.